We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 6, The Hero with a Thousand Genres. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Tyson Pugh about how the Harry Potter novels intermingle many genres, though perhaps not quite a thousand. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we are going to talk with Dr. Tyson Pugh, who has recently published a book that explores the literary genres influencing Harry Potter. Now, Emily, when you started reading the novels, what genre did you think you were in?
Good question. Here's the genre that I thought I was in. Not theology.
That's how you break them down? There's theology and then there's the not theology.
Well, at the time for me, that was how it was because I had just completed my first semester of my master's program in theology. And they had kind of gone a little crazy on us because it was a newish program for the program. And they had assigned a lot of dense books for us to read, which I really enjoyed doing after having taken 3 years off of school. So, but my brain was pretty tired. Mm-hmm. And when somebody handed me, my best friend Kukwa handed me the Harry Potter books, the first three, she said, oh, these will be like candy for you. And so I just devoured them. I didn't care what they were.
It's the candy genre.
It was the candy genre. Yeah, it really was. It just and then it was a great irony of my life when 7 books later I realized, oh, indeed, they are theology.
There you go. That's funny. Yeah. Now, I mean, I also read them when I was in graduate school and I just needed something else. And I thought I was reading children's books, you know, secondarily fantasy. And my guess is that those are the ones people think they're getting into when they pick up the books because of the way it's marketed and the way it's talked about and all that. But I do think that once we got to the end of the Sorcerer's Stone, when Snape was not the villain in that piece, I did start to think maybe I was reading something that was categorically different, doing something more interesting with mystery, with plot, with character. And I was like, this is kind of exciting. And I don't exactly know. I don't exactly know how to predict it, which is a lot of what genre does. It kind of helps you to know where should the story be taking me.
Right. And, you know, honestly, Katie, I didn't have a whole lot of experience with genre fiction before Harry Potter. I was more of a kind of classics reader. I had never read Tolkien. I was not into Star Wars even. I know that's hard for some of our listeners to believe, but
Harry Potter was your gateway drug.
Harry Potter was a real gateway. Yeah, it was definitely a gateway for me into genre fiction.
Yeah. Well, our special guest for this episode, who is here to help us untangle some of these genres and the expectations that go along with them, is Dr. Tyson Pugh, Pegasus Professor of English at the University of Central Florida. He has written several books, including Queering Medieval Genres, Chaucer's Losers, Nintendo's Children, and other forays into queer ludonarratology, and the subject of our conversation today, Harry Potter and Beyond, on J.K. Rowling's Fantasies and Other Fictions, which is just out from the University of South Carolina Press in 2020. Well, welcome to the show, Tyson.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tyson, your field is medieval literature, although I saw that you do southern literature as well.
Yes.
But you particularly do queer and gender studies. How did this lead you to Harry Potter as a subject of analysis?
Well, it sounds like I was led to Harry Potter very much like you two were.
Okay.
In that I was in graduate school and needed to turn my brain off a little. And also, it was, the late-ish 90s. And so I just wanted to see what all the fuss was about with these new Harry Potter books.
Yeah, me too.
And so, So at the end of Sorcerer's Stone, when Dumbledore says to Neville, you know, the line about it takes a great deal of bravery to stand up to our enemies, but even more, just as much to stand up to our friends, I just knew I was a fan for life. And it stuck with me for that. You know, when Goblet of Fire came out, and I literally stayed up all night to get to the end. You just knew that these books were going to be with you for a very long time. And then I really moved into Harry Potter as a field of study, around 2006 or 7 or so. And it was that I was not happy with Dumbledore's death. And I liked him as a character too much to die. And so a colleague of mine and I wrote an article about, it's called Heteronormative Heroism and Queering the School Story in J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series. And we talked about just how the framework of the novel makes it so that Dumbledore as a character has to die, that Harry, you know, needs to be able to ascend into his place as the rightful hero. But then my interest in children's literature was growing at that time as well. And so I had a chapter on Harry Potter for a book I did on children's literature. And then it just came to me, I'll bet my students would enjoy a class on Harry Potter. And the administration at UCF was very, my school, University of Central Florida, was very enthusiastic. And so the book that I wrote really just came out of the lectures that I did for the class. And so it's just kind of been a cumulative effect over the years. And so, I started and I still am in the field of medievalist, but all literature works in somewhat similar ways. And so the ways that I analyze medieval literature are not too terribly different from the ways that I analyze the Harry Potter books.
That's fascinating. We've done some, conversations with people who've talked about some of the medieval elements in Harry Potter as well, just sort of drawing on some medieval stories and so on. And is your class called Harry Potter and Beyond?
It's called Harry Potter Studies.
Harry Potter Studies.
Oh, very good.
Well, wonderful. Yeah. Absolutely.
And if I can just say, Tyson, the book is really accessible in terms of, it's an academic book, but it's really accessible to the average reader. And so even think that, yeah, you're welcome. A lot of undergraduate students would particularly enjoy this.
One does not have to use jargon to write well.
Exactly.
Oh, absolutely. And
right,
I mean, I think, it's the kind of thing that I think really anybody can pick up. But people who are, scholars and who are working in the area of Potter studies, I think are also going to find it really valuable. So I definitely would recommend this. So Tyson, if you would talk to us a little bit about your book and its sort of central purpose in Harry Potter and Beyond. You've examined the ways that the Harry Potter novels both follow and manipulate genre conventions. Which genres does Rowling draw on in these novels, and why these particularly?
Okay, yeah. In the book, I have chapters on Harry Potter, and the first chapter is obviously fantasy. Fantasy is the foundational genre, I would say, of the series. Mm-hmm. But also it has elements of the school story, Bildungsromans, mystery novels, and allegories. And I actually have a new article coming out on Harry Potter and the sentimental tradition. And
oh,
so,
cool.
But I think this is what thanks. I hope so. it's one of those things. I wish it were part of the book, but sometimes your thinking doesn't match up with your publication deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
So, but just, from the base of fantasy, I think she's able to build such a more engrossing story by using these other elements. And so just for a quick example, right, one of the best things about the books is Hogwarts. And it's just such a memorable setting for these stories to unfold in. And so that's definitely, descended from, but innovated from the school story tradition as well. And then, the Bildungsroman genre is often focused on protagonist growth, usually beginning into childhood, into adulthood. Usually they're, somewhat separated or feel a lack of connection to their society. And so that helps us, to see Harry's emotional maturation, which is important because his maturation as a hero really he doesn't need to mature as a hero. He's just as brave in Sorcerer's Stone as he is in Deathly Hallows. So he's always, you know, a great hero, but it's fun to see him grow in terms of, say, his dating life, where, bless his little heart, he does have a thing or two to learn. And then, you know, mystery novels are just such a great genre in themselves. They're really one of the more addictive storytelling formulas, where there's a mystery. And so it's a riddle, it's a puzzle, and readers want to know the answer to those puzzles. And so Chamber of Secrets and Goblet of Fire, I would say, are probably the two episodes most invested in the mystery novel, especially Chamber of Secrets. It's, you know, there's lots of talk about solving the mystery and gathering clues in that book in particular. And then I think that the allegorical elements of the story, of the novels as well, really build its depth and thematic complexity. So, you know, the battle against Voldemort is aligned to the battle against Hitler. It's definitely a World War II allegory in some key ways. And it comes out most in Deathly Hallows, but you can see that she's planned it just in the references to the duel between Dumbledore and Grindelwald, which happens all the way back in Sorcerer's Stone. And then, of course, the other major allegory I see in the novels is Harry as a Christ figure who sacrifices himself for others. So that's kind of the book in a nutshell in terms of its analysis of genres. But just what she's able to do, right? A lot of fantasy stories are just very comfortable within the realm of fantasy, and they don't really move out of it. And that's what's often seen as a key limitation of genre fiction across the different genres, across sci-fi or mystery novels or fantasy, that they're content just to be a fantasy novel. I shouldn't say just, but they're content within their genre. But what she's done is take that basic framework of the fantasy mythic hero and really expand it into some fascinating other directions.
Yeah, and some genres that you wouldn't necessarily think are going to be connected together.
Right.
And
yeah.
One of the things that I think is it's an important part of your discussion, even in the beginning of the book, you talk about the distinction between literary fiction and genre fiction, and that there is a kind of, if I may say, a bit of a snobbish idea
right.
of what constitutes literature with a capital L, and then there are things that are maybe more like pulp. And
right.
The genres can seem like, I guess they're formulaic, and that's part of why people don't want to see them as literary. What do you think about that in terms of Harry Potter? Would you say that it should be considered as literary fiction, or should we actually just be paying more attention to genre fiction because it's not as beneath us?
Yes, I like the second option better.
They're
both fine options, but genre fiction has I guess one way to think about it is there's a lot of great literary fiction and there's a lot of really bad literary fiction. Just because an author writes in the literary fiction mode doesn't mean it's going to be a good book. And think about, you know, right. And just think about the history of literature or being an English literature major. For English literature majors, we read the best of literary fiction in a lot of our classes and not the crappy stuff that people have forgotten about because it wasn't any good. But I think, you know, kind of the same, but the opposite happens with genre fiction. A lot of genre fiction does just adhere to the kind of the rules of the genre and doesn't do anything new or innovative with the form. And so, you can get bored with that formula if you've read enough of it. But if you're doing something with that basic structure that you're then adding to, and again, that's why I think why Rowling's books are so successful, that she's able to take the foundation of fantasy and infuse it with so many other elements, I think it's doing a disservice to her accomplishments to say that Harry Potter is quote unquote just genre fiction.
Right.
Yeah, that reminds me of Cecilia Contarfar. I'm constantly referring to that book, The Ulysses Delusion. Fabulous, fabulous book where, you know, she looks at a lot of these same issues.
Right. And her idea is that we have this idea that we should all be reading Ulysses, but what are we all reading? We're all reading The Firm, you know?
Oprah's book club books.
But we should actually be paying attention to those because they're good, and that's why people are reading them, and we don't need to be snobs about that. And
right.
I think that the mixing of the genres is also interesting because I wonder if that also helps to bring in readers of all kinds, you know, people
right.
who like mysteries, not just people who like fantasy or children, right? Adults are reading it.
And it's also important to remember just how this shifts historically, because now Charles Dickens is firmly in the realm of high culture,
Oh,
which he
right.
most emphatically was not when his books were published. Everyone was reading Dickens. And
Right.
so the idea that Dickens would be, you know, treated as Shakespeare would be treated in the Victorian era was just ridiculous. But now, right, you have a class, most English departments would have a class on Dickens and a class on Shakespeare. So time influences how we see these genres as well.
Absolutely. Right. That's a great point. So I was really interested also in the way that you talked about the gender dynamic of the novels being influenced by the genres that Rowling is using. So, for example, the hero's myth or fairy tales. So how does the hero's myth affect the gender dynamic of the Harry Potter novels?
I can, you know, kind of answer that by describing an exercise we do in my class. And in that we, you know, when we're discussing the mythic hero, I just have, in my class, I have the students broken down into the houses, of course. And so each house has to just brainstorm as quickly as possible as many similarities between Harry Potter and Moses, King Arthur, Superman, and Luke Skywalker as possible.
Oh, so, that's awesome.
I enjoy this day. It's a good exercise. And so, you know, they start to realize that these characters are in many ways structurally the same, right? They're all raised away from their parents. They don't really know about their birth culture. They all have great initiation scenes, Moses with the burning bush, Arthur with the sword and the stone, Harry, obviously, with the letters from Hogwarts that will come through any opening into his house. They're all mysteriously connected to their adversary, like Harry and Voldemort are distant cousins, and they have all those other connections about speaking parcel tongue and such. You know, Mordred is King Arthur's son, Moses is raised as an Egyptian, and, you know, they have to sacrifice their personal lives and fight on, you know, against this outside evil. But one of the things that I really hope that my students pick up on is just the kind of the most obvious thing, and then sometimes that's the most difficult to see, is that they're all male figures. And, you know, and how, just in terms of how Rowling has talked about how the idea of Harry Potter came to her, she describes it as kind of a Venus on the half shell moment, except it's Harry, you know, and he comes to her fully formed, and she just always saw him as a male figure. And I think that's important to think about how she's working within this mythic hero tradition, which has been, you know, predominantly male. And so another thing that I add to that exercise in class is a lot of times I like to do a lesson and then offer kind of a meta critique of it. And, you know, I ask them, well, wait, why weren't there any women in this lesson? And that's a really good moment for them to think about how this narrative pattern has been structured male, and how even some characters we might think of as female mythic heroes diverge from it as well, like Wonder Woman or Katniss from The Hunger Games and such like that. One of the most interesting things about genres for me to think about them is the ways in which gender is encoded into them. And, you know, I think we can see some ways in which Rowling is replicating the genders of these genres in very traditional ways. And there are some other ways that she's not. And so you mentioned as well about fairy tales. And so, well, we can think about, well, Hagrid is kind of a fairy godmother figure. And so she's able to play with gender in some interesting ways with these genres, either in another way, she's reinforcing the same patterns we've seen before.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And you were talking about the, you know, the hero's myth, you know, takes the hero into this other realm.
Right.
But fairy tales are very domestic.
Yes.
And so there is this balance in the Harry Potter novels between the, you know, the kind of the enormous battle between good and evil and things that are a little bit more smaller and domestic that right. are referencing fairy tales.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, that's, again, one of, I think, the strengths of the series. She's able to have this epic battle, but then there's lots of very personal scenes at home, right? And so for me, one of the most powerful scenes is when Molly Weasley is fighting the Boggart, who's taking the shape of, you know, her dead children. Mm. And it's just such a powerful moment, but it's not a moment you necessarily see in most epic battle.
I always think about the epilogue, the much right. hated epilogue.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very domestic.
But it's the bow. It's the wrapping up right. of the domestic right. part of it.
Yeah. Right. I'm not an epilogue hater.
Okay.
I think it works pretty well for just the reasons you're saying. It lets us know that these characters are okay, even several years later. I have a stronger criticism of Cursed Child. So.
Yes, we will jump on that bandwagon. At least I will jump on that bandwagon. No, and I think the epilogue, I think one of the things that made me realize the importance of the epilogue is I did a paper that I have coming out soon on parenting in Harry Potter and what it means and why it's so emphasized. And you know, when it comes down to it, parenting is on some levels about immortality and your own immortality. And it's like the one acceptable way to pursue immortality. But it, you know, it matters how you do it. But that epilogue really showed us the character's true path to immortality. And of course, they're very different from Voldemort's path, but they're the peaceful path to immortality. Right. So, but I'd like to talk about politics. You talk about politics in the book and how the politics align with the genre convention. So how do the politics of the wizarding world fit into the different genre conventions that you talk about, the buildings Roman, the school story? Is she just giving us the politics we would expect from that genre convention, or are we getting her politics?
I mean, that's a great question, and it's really difficult to disentangle, right? I mean, I can't speak for Rowling on, you know, what her own personal vision was for so many of these issues. But just in terms of, you know, how she set up the narratives is that Harry is the voice of resistance. And so, you know, we have, if we take Cornelius Fudge as kind of the default representative of the phlegmatic bureaucracy, right? And so that's a... not necessarily a bureaucracy, but that's what a Bildungsroman is often about, the individual having to stand up for him or herself against these social forces that just refuse to listen to them. And so I think that's also the case with the school stories, right? That a lot of times the student sees the truth of the institution in a way that the teachers and school administration doesn't. And so they're blind to what's happening in the classrooms. And the protagonist of the story has to be the one to say, well, wait a second, this is actually the truth of our school here. So, you know, I mean, we know about Rowling's politics that they're generally, you know, to the left. She's pro-European Union. She's anti-Brexit, you know, et cetera. Obviously, her recent statements about trans individuals have really upset many people, rightly so, because we kind of assumed that her leftist views, you know, went across the spectrum and didn't have a firm stopping point, as we now know they do. So, but just for your question about, you know, how the politics intersects with the genres, a lot of genres, just by their very focus on an individual, is going to be that individual against the society. And I think that does align a little bit more with a leftist viewpoint, which is going to, you know, kind of show the limitations of the current system and how it needs to be changed. And so if we're speaking just in very general terms, right, a conservative worldview is going to more likely say that the system is fine. And so that's why I think we can see Fudge is, you know, refusing to see any disruption to this world order. And Harry is the one who has to say, no, wait, there is a huge problem that you're overlooking.
Yeah, one of the things I think is interesting is the school story is so imperialistic, right? It's Age of Empire. And I've gotten interested in the elements of colonialism that are evident in the Harry Potter novels. And I have a paper that's coming out, a chapter in a book that's coming out that's sort of, you know, dealing with that and how the genres that Rowling uses are leading her in that direction. Now, I looked at her little snippets on Wizarding World, which used to be Pottermore, and I talk about how she is sort of using a pseudo history genre form that is also within an imperial time of understanding British history. And this leads her into some things that are pretty colonialist. And she's not always self-critical about that, I think. And I think that's true in the novels, too.
Yeah, or even self-aware. You have to wonder about that. You know, if she's even kind of aware
I think the genre can lead you to some things that are there are these like underlying assumptions that maybe you're not even really thinking about.
These books have a history, and so they're responding to that history. And even as much as an author wants to innovate from them, right, in which ways are they guiding them, right, into their plot points and beyond?
You know, I think it's interesting. Of course, she's choosing the genres that she's playing around with, and so her choice of the genre conventions is also like that's a little act of free will there.
Yes.
And so it, in some ways, it suits the story that she wants to tell. Like you were saying, story of resistance and, you know, kind of challenging the age-old institutions. Detective fiction or mystery is one of the genres that Rowling draws on, as you mentioned, but Harry is a pretty bad detective. He's not so great at that.
No.
He doesn't really fit the mold of the protagonist within those stories. How does that influence our vision of him as a protagonist in that kind of story?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's just one of the funniest parts of the whole series is that Harry's a great hero. He's going to rush in to battle no matter the odds against him, even when he's being lured in to battle. Harry, think twice, Harry. I mean, we know he's not a great thinker. So I think this is a really great way for Rowling to, you know, have his heroism or just his whole character be a bit more human. Right, that he is a great hero, but that's not all there is to a character. That's not all there is to a human. And so this really sets up his failings and his need for others to help him. So, right, in Chamber of Secrets, it's Hermione who solves the mystery. She's just petrified, so she can't do anything about it. And so then Harry is able to take over and do the heroic thing. But yeah, the series would have a very different and much more abrupt ending if Harry had to solve the mystery of the Chamber of Secrets rather than just going in and defeating the basilisk at the end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's a really great innovation to the mythic hero tradition. And again, just thinking about, you know, the ones that I do the class exercise, Moses, King Arthur, Luke Skywalker, Superman, none of these are detectives. I mean, the only one who would even come close is Superman. But there's a important distinction between crime fighter, that's what Superman is, and a detective. Right. And so Superman generally is not going around collecting clues and such like that. So here Rowling has given us a mythic hero who is a bad detective. And that's an interesting just spin on the mythic hero formula, but also, you know, shows us Harry really needs his companions. Hermione is just not just a superfluous character. We need her intellect there or things are going to fall apart.
That you can even see that from, you know, from the Sorcerer's Stone, like right. that Hermione, yeah. She's got the logic, she's well-read, she's very attentive to details and so on. And so she's really our detective protagonist.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really worth considering the ways in which Hermione is in some way set up to be the hero of Sorcerer's Stone, because she solves, you know, a couple of the problems to get to the final boss battle, if you will, against Voldemort. But then she's just, no, I'm going to go off and Harry, you take it. But is that really the ending that we had to have? And in some ways, right, again, the narrative pressure, it's Harry Potter, you know, and the Sorcerer's Stone. So he's going to have that final battle. But, you know, just as you were saying earlier, how a genre gives an author a framework to build from, but it's not an iron bound, you know, drawn in blood contract. Mm-hmm. And so that Hermione was not allowed to be the one, because you really didn't have to do anything to defeat Quirrell, right? You just had to, I mean, had to attack Harry, I guess. So
be idealistic.
Way, right. But, you know, Hermione could have taken him down too, I'm pretty sure. With that brain.
I always wonder at how many people identify so strongly with Hermione when Harry is really the far more relatable character, because he is just more sort of mediocre, you know, and Hermione is just so fiercely untouchably talented.
Well, but they do say that Harry is often not one of the favorite characters in the books. When people ask people who their favorite characters are, not a lot of people actually end up saying Harry. And so I wonder if, you know, if that plays... I don't know. Yeah, I think it's interesting.
So. Yeah.
Well, he's like the empty vessel character, like Luke Skywalker, who you're invited to pour yourself into subconsciously. Yeah. And we don't always recognize that we're doing that. And it's very satisfying, but that doesn't mean that we recognize that we're doing it. But we admire Hermione because she's, you know, totally awesome.
Fate often intervenes for Harry, right? In that way, he doesn't need to, he just needs to be himself. Is, you know, one of the major themes of the stories. And so, but Hermione has to work for it a bit more than Harry does. So,
You know, one of the things I thought was interesting when I was kind of looking, I'm always looking for good quotes to bring in. And I was looking at the one when Hermione kind of talks to Harry about how she's not sure that he's really like hearing from Sirius in the Order of the Phoenix. And she's like, you know, Harry, you do, you have a saving people thing. And it's like, yeah. Hermione's calling out the genre yeah. that they're in. And yeah. she's like, yeah. you know, yeah. Voldemort knows that you're a hero in the hero's myth, and he might be using that.
Yes.
Has anyone here considered the genre that we're in?
Yeah, exactly. A very good question for Hermione to ask. And Harry wouldn't know what she was talking about, so he'd just go on and do what he was going to do anyway.
Right, but, right. It's funny to think about Harry as not a very good detective throughout the series. Although I have to say, he puts a lot of things together quickly at the end of Deathly Hallows. So maybe that's kind of a redemption moment for him as a detective. But it must have been sort of very compelling for Rowling to write the Robert Galbraith books, you know, and write somebody like Cormoran Strike, who is so competent and so, you know, on top of his role. So that must have been very cathartic for her.
Yeah. After having
and who actually does solve the mysteries, right?
Yeah.
He's a detective, and he's able to piece together the clues. And I mean, what's nice, and I think what is her kind of innovation there, is that he does rely on his assistant more than most detectives rely on their assistants. It's much more a relationship of equals between Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott than, say, you know, Perry Mason and Della Street or something like that. Mm-hmm. The detective is usually a sole detective in detective novels. They don't really work in teams. And if they do have a partner, it's usually just to show up how smart they are. Right. So
Watson
is
Watson.
Just,
oh,
you know,
gosh.
Yes. Is there to reflect the glory that is Sherlock Holmes. And Robin Ellicott's position in the Strike novels is quite different. So I like what she's done with gender in that series on that regard.
Well, I was really interested in the chapter that you wrote on allegory, because I'm always interested in the Christian themes of the series. And I thought, interestingly, you suggested that Rowling, perhaps because of the demand of writing for children, sanitizes the violence of both of her two major allegorical subjects, which are, you know, World War II, as you said, and the Passion of Jesus. What do you think is the effect of this sanitizing on the reader?
Well, I think this is, you know, really gets to one of the most vexing issues about children's literature, and that is, you know, who is it for, and what age is reading it? And so obviously you don't want, you know, as a general rule, you don't want to sanitize the horrors of World War II. You don't want to sanitize the horrors of the Holocaust. This is something that humanity needs to look directly on. But at the same time, you know, is an 8-year-old ready for the full horrors of the Holocaust? Maybe not. And so we have this real tension between what she's trying to do with the stories and her adult readers, who have a certain level of expectation of what they're doing, versus what she's doing for younger readers. She's mentioned several times that she tries not to talk down to children, her children readers. And I think that's really admirable. And here's one point where we can say, well, yeah, but you probably did hear. And yet, in these instances, I can see the need for it as well. So it's just a really perplexing issue to kind of confront. What do you put forth for a child reader? And so I think, you know, kind of how I would sum up my view on it is that I would hope children who grow up to reread the books can then see in some ways that, yes, it is a sanitized allegory, and see, you know, kind of the complexity of what she's doing. But, you know, how a 10-year-old and how a 30-year-old is going to read these books is quite different. And I think her treatment of these allegorical issues really highlights that.
Yeah, and I think she has said also that she was trying to be sensitive to the fact that she had child readers. Like, the way that Cedric gets killed is done in the most direct way, you know, without it being gruesome and drawn out and so on. And she was sensitive to who a lot of her readers were. But it does make, you know, it makes gestures to, there's some pretty gruesome stuff that happens right after Cedric's death, you know, that are pretty, you know, that are pretty dark compared to what at least you used to get in, you know, children's YA fiction. Although I think we've seen a lot, you know, since she's been able to do it, other people have been bringing some of those, you know, darker images in as well.
Yeah, I think the genre has matured a lot in the last 20 years, definitely. But I mean, even that, you know, even that you mentioned YA, that's another of those great perplexing questions. When does children's literature end and YA literature begin, and who reads YA literature? And the last time I read an article that said that the major readers of YA literature are adults. You know, so it really is a kind of an interesting melange of writers envisioning an audience, and then that audience might not necessarily match up with who they envisioned. And so then we have conflicting ideas of what the story should do and who they should be speaking to.
Well, of course, Rowling also has written for adult audiences, like intentionally, with the Casual Vacancy and the Cormoran Strike books that we've talked about. And those can be quite grisly. And, you know, very, like, I feel sometimes unnecessarily gruesome.
I had to hide the last Cormoran Strike book from my child. Like, I literally, he, because he knows it's by J.K. Rowling, and he would, you know, kind of like want to leaf through it and just read it a little bit. I had to like hide it because some of the illustrations and some of the language in it, and definitely the violence.
Yeah. But I mean, she's writing for these novels in the, you know, if we want to speak about genre, not detective fiction as a, you know, over, well, as an overarching category, but more specifically within the subcategory of hard-boiled. And the hard-boiled genre or subgenre does not shy away from, you know, pretty gruesome depictions of violence. You know, so it's a completely different readership, I think we can, you know, say that she's envisioning for these books. Hopefully she is envisioning them. But then at what point, you know, I think it's a great question for parents. And it's actually, you know, a question I do ask my students. Just a very simple one. At what age will you allow them to read the Harry Potter books for the first time? Some of them say, you know, 6 or 7, some say 10. And we kind of talk about that. What are their different expectations of what a, you know, a child reader is able to handle? But for the Cormoran Strike books, not for the child reader.
Right. And I did, you know, I have 3 kids, and my first one wasn't really interested in them until he was about 9, and then he devoured them. And then, but my littlest guy, he wanted to be interested in them right away. And so when he was like even 5 or 6, we'd started reading the books to him. But at some point in book 4, I was like, we're not reading this anymore. Cause I thought book 4 was like, this stuff's getting real, you know? And I could just tell it was a little too much for him.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, right? The first kids who read these books literally grew up with them because they weren't all published in the same year, obviously.
Right.
So you could read, you know, as a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, if you read or had read to you Sorcerer's Stone, then you were ready for the next one because they really do mature in complexity as they go. But now they're all available. And so it's a different reading experience to have all 7 available to you. And as a child, that might then depend on which ones your parents are willing to give to you.
Right.
Or which ones you can read at your friend's house when they're not looking.
I seem to remember a story. I think it might have been on an episode of MuggleNet Academia, where one scholar was talking about how she was reading the first book aloud to her like 8 or 9 or 10-year-old and not really thinking about it very much until she realized she got to the scene where Voldemort is in the dark forest, forbidden forest, and he's drinking the unicorn blood. And then he rises up and he goes after Harry, and Harry narrowly escapes. And she didn't realize it, but her 5-year-old had been in the room the whole time listening. And she only realized it because of the blood-curdling screams that emitted from a corner while her 5-year-old fled from the scene.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably all of us have that memory of something we saw in childhood that we weren't ready, whether it was a book or a movie or, you know, something in real life. And, you know, we all made it past it, I hope, but those are the moments that stick with us. I mean, my little story like that is, I still remember the title. I saw like on regular TV, this horror movie, Burnt Offerings, when I was like 7. And I literally decided I would never watch horror movies again at 7. And by college, I decided I was wrong. And now I like horror movies. But, you know, that was really a defining moment just in terms of who I was as a reader or as a watcher and such like that. And so hopefully your child will get over the horrors of unicorn blood, it might take a while.
I remember mine was a Hitchcock movie. I totally remember it was a particular scene because, you know, Hitchcock, you can be watching for a while and nothing really awful happens. And then it was like, oh my God. So, I mean, I think also like in thinking about the violence, you know, fairy tales and heroes myths often do have a lot of violence and, you know, battling and making war and those kinds of things. And so, you know, those things I do think are always kind of in there with the idea that, especially for fairy tales, that children do have violence in their lives often.
Oh, sure.
And that we shouldn't just assume that they have to be, you know, sanitized, like Disney sanitized, all that stuff out.
Well, and that there's different levels of sanitizing. There's different ways of sanitizing. Right. And some ways don't, you know, they do. I appreciate your point earlier about how even sometimes sanitized depictions of things like World War II can lead a young person to investigate more in the truth. And this is absolutely true. My son is 9 and he's much more into Star Wars than Harry Potter, but he knows that both of those works have elements of, you know, the kind of totalitarianism we saw in Hitler. And so he became interested in how Hitler rose to power. I think current events also gave him an interest in that. And he sat down and watched a recent Frontline special on the rise of the Nazis. And he watched every single episode of that and was absolutely glued to it, including times when I was like, I'm not actually sure this is age appropriate for you. But you know what? I didn't stop him because I was inspired by his interest in that and hopeful that he wanted to know more and wanted to understand how people like this gain power.
Yeah, it's just, it's such an impossible question. I feel, you know, just for the struggle of elementary school teachers who then have to respond to the parents as well. But how do you know with a class of 25 students that is everyone going to be emotionally ready for this? And, you know, you don't want to set the lesson at the level of the kid who is least ready for it, but then you have to be cognizant of that child as well. And it's just, you know, every child matures differently and is ready for scenes of violence or of sex or anything like that at least a slightly different period.
Right.
So Tyson, I'm intrigued by the, to put you on the spot, the additional genre that you see going on in the Harry Potter novels of the sentimental novel. And would you be willing to tell us a little bit about how you think that's in evidence in the Harry Potter novels?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the sentimental novel is a very longstanding tradition, and just its defining feature is a heightened emotionalism. And so I think there's some key scenes where Rowling is really going for our emotions. And so, like, one that I mentioned already in this discussion and in the article is when Molly Weasley is weeping over her not dead children, but just the image of seeing them dead. And so I look at several other moments where I really think she's trying to get her readers invested in the characters. And so one of the things that I find, you know, just in my class, one of the most divisive issues is Snape. And is Snape redeemed at the end? And one of the things that I think she's doing in the books, and a lot of my students disagree quite vehemently, but I think she's using the tropes of the sentimental novel to get us to empathize and sympathize for Snape. And so there's the part where, you know, we get Dumbledore's words to Harry, something to the effect of, you know, don't pity the dead, Harry, pity the living, and above all, those who live without love. And that's Snape, right? Mm-hmm. That's a real clear focus on Snape. He's the main character in the novel who lives without love, even more so than Voldemort, right? I mean, Voldemort, I mean, you don't want to call the Death Eaters his friends per se, but he's obviously charismatic to a degree that Snape is not.
His adorers.
So, exactly.
And he doesn't know what he's missing either. Like, he's not really capable of love and loving, but Snape is.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just, one of the things about the sentimental novel tradition as well is that it's often very explicitly didactic. And so, you know, one of the greatest examples of the sentimental novel is Uncle Tom's Cabin with a very clear message. Slavery is a horrible, horrible evil and we must abolish it. And so for this, I think the message is about, you know, that the very human need for love and how it deforms Snape and how even though it's difficult and even though he does some really horrible things, and my students like to point out, he has a stalker tendencies. I still think within the overarching scope of the books, we're meant to really sympathize with him in a way that we don't need to sympathize with the other characters. Harry doesn't need our sympathy. He might need our cheers, but everyone's always on his side.
Except Snape.
Well, except Snape.
But he is fundamental.
I mean,
yeah. Right. Snape is saving Harry. Yes. Yeah. Snape saves Harry several times.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's really just fascinating. So, let's talk a little bit about the beyond part of Harry Potter. What's your philosophy on how we should regard the Potter canon? Like, what do you think of as the canon, and you know, what's a little outside of that? And would you consider things like the films or The Cursed Child to be part of that canon?
Yeah. I just, in terms of, you know, the canon, I, you know, probably in the minority here, but I'm a bit of a purist, and I just think the seven books are the canon. And, you know, I like the movies. I love the theme park. I live in Orlando. The theme park is great. And they're great additions to the world. But, you know, Rowling would disagree with me, because she's said quite clearly that, you know, certain things are canon. She's made what she has declared are canonical pronouncements on Twitter and such like that. So one of the things about defining the canon, and this is actually true of any canon, is no one can define it, right? And so just any class you take in English literature or American literature or world literature is going to define a canon just by the very fact of coming up with a syllabus for the course or a table of contents of an anthology. But canons are always being reformulated and reimagined. Mm-hmm. So I just, for me, everything, and I hate to say it, but it's true, everything that Rowling has added to the canon after Deathly Hallows hasn't been to me a great addition. So just that she can give us backstories on all these characters that we didn't really need doesn't add to the thrill and the, you know, the efficacy of her works. So I think she should have put her pen down after Deathly Hallows.
Yeah, you are not alone there. I think there are people who would totally agree with that. And, you know, in The Cursed Child, it's not even really clear to what degree she had an influence on that. And I've always thought of that as a kind of author's thought experiment on, you know, what if Cedric hadn't died, or, you know, and so it's a way to kind of confirm the story that she already told. But it feels more like fan fiction to me.
That's what a lot of people say about it, that it feels very fan fiction-y to it. And to that, I would say, to me, it feels like more B plus fan fiction.
Mm-hmm. Not even the good stuff.
Yeah, that there's other A-plus fan fiction, that if you want to read fan fiction, go find the A-plus fan fiction rather than necessarily Cursed Child. And I saw it, and I enjoyed it, and I've read it, and it's fine, but it's very much a rehash of, as you said, what happened if Cedric didn't die. So Goblet of Fire might be, you know, it's hard to pick my favorite of the seven novels, but let's just say Goblet of Fire now. Going back to Goblet of Fire didn't make it more enjoyable, right? We've already been there. We've been to the Triwizard Tournament and all of that. And it was really fresh and exciting when I first read Goblet of Fire and literally stayed up all night to get to the end. But for the return visit, I wasn't nearly as invested. But I think it's really great. You know, the fanon has shown that J.K. Rowling can't limit the canon itself. That fanon has just taken on a life of its own in ways that she could have never imagined. And so, you know, at my university, like lots of universities, we have a Quidditch team, which is just absolutely fantastic. But that's actually a great example of how the fanon is in some ways better, because Quidditch, right, even if we did have brooms, would be incredibly impossible to play. But these, you know, the people who play Quidditch have made it a playable game. They brought it into reality in a really great way.
Don't get me started on Quidditch.
Okay. I didn't know. Quidditch
is Emily's jam.
It is. Okay. It is my, but it's my jam in terms of the symbolism of it with regards to the story and how it mirrors the story and the plot line. But it's funny. It is interesting. It kind of, I've always seen it as proving my point that when Muggles play it, they tweak all these rules, because the rules don't make it a good sport. It makes it a good symbol set, but it doesn't make it a good sport. So they change it so it can actually function as a sport.
And
which is,
I think they're on like their 10th rule book now.
Yeah.
The first rule book was just a couple of Xeroxed pages, or, you know, a PDF of 10 pages. And now it's a professionally published book. And so they've, you know, kept building it into a bigger and better game.
And there's so many people who are doing it. I did a little bit on looking at Quidditch in the kind of imperialism realm. And the way that the people who play Quidditch are trying to bring the values of the books into the sport that they're playing. Some people are playing it just because they like the game, but a lot of them are playing because, you know, they want to have a sport that brings them into that world, and that, you know, that that is, that has these gender equities in it, you know, and right. that is, you know, sort of celebrating those more liberal values that they found in the books. Yeah.
And Quidditch, I mean, you know, our real life Quidditch is definitely trans inclusive. Mm-hmm. And that's a, you know, really striking difference from, again, what Rowling has said herself. So we can build a better fandom than perhaps is allowed even in the books.
Well, that's one of the things I really liked about your book is uh-huh. that you don't avoid the author's perspectives and point of view and what she's tried to opine into canon, and yet you don't allow it to limit your own interpretation of it. And I found that really refreshing throughout the book.
That was a rush to get in the book.
I bet.
The trans story was pretty much breaking as we were going into proofs. And so I had to send a frantic email to the press saying, this has got to be in.
Yeah.
This is going to mm-hmm. be the dominant topic of conversation about Harry Potter for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. And so thank goodness they allowed me to add a couple of paragraphs addressing this issue, because the book would have already, all books are out of date as soon as they come out.
Yeah.
But this one would have been even more out of date, even faster, if I had not been able to include those couple of paragraphs.
Well, and, your introduction did address the question of whether we should analyze the books with Rowling's life and intentions in mind. Like, you do a really nice summary of her as an author, and then you sort of talk about how that interacts with the books that she's writing. What do you think are the pitfalls and benefits of, you know, paying attention to the author? And what's ultimately your view on that, Tyson?
Well, I mean, one way to think about it is just kind of a, you know, little mental exercise is, would I like this book just as much as if it were published anonymously, right? Does it really matter that there's a person's name and, of course, a person behind the book? Because the story is separate from the person who wrote it. And so, sure, it can be a bit illuminating to know more about an author's life. And then you catch such facts as, oh, Harry's birthday, that's the same as J.K. Rowling's birthday. Or, oh, the Dementors. Yeah, that does seem like the conversation or embodiment of depression. And Rowling's been very candid about her struggles with depression. So there are some ways that's illuminating. But then, even with those points, I kind of come back to that question. Well, does it matter that these images of Dementors were perhaps inspired by real life experiences? Because at the end of it, they are fictional creations. And so I'm going to read them as fictional creations. So I, you know, for the most part, I think it doesn't make a huge amount of difference. And I mean, I definitely want to kind of think about this in relation to her anti-trans statements in a little bit, but for anyone who's troubled by an author, I think that's a great thing to do, to just say, well, okay, I'm just going to read this book as if it were published anonymously, because the book can still have value. Bad people can write great books.
That's a good thing to just, that's just a good thing to have in mind. Bad people can write good books.
I'm immediately thinking of H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, H.P. Lovecraft.
I mean, there's examples throughout literary history. You know, I teach a class on Chaucer, and one of the most troubling elements from Chaucer's biography is that he may have raped a woman. But, you know, when I discuss that element of his life, a lot of my students are troubled by it. And so we take some time to think about, you know, how does the author's life influence our enjoyment of the text? That a lot of readers see themselves kind of simultaneously as fans, too. And that's not something that I discourage, because it can, you know, increase enthusiasm for a class. But I think that's the kind of the double edge to mixing fandom with reading, that fandom is much more associated with supporting the person behind the artwork.
Mm-hmm. And I think with Rowling, too, I think a lot of people felt like they knew where she was on everything. And then it's really the disappointment, you know, that they felt like her politics and her, like the way she was as a person and her view of diversity and those kinds of issues was perfectly reflected in the novels, which people were then like taking on as their own. And then all of a sudden you hit this, as you said, this kind of closed off point, and it's very disappointing.
Yeah. And readers were, you know, very willing to give her the benefit of the doubt and say, you know, and so just, I mean, for example, one of the things that's long troubled a lot of readers is, you know, the character name of Cho Chang, which seems, you know, just
right,
very stereotypical. And, you know, surely she could have done a little better than Cho Chang. But at the same time, a lot of readers said as well, well, she was writing in the 90s, you know, and we've learned more. We have a deeper understanding of multiculturalism and what it means to write fiction that envisions itself as depicting a multicultural world. And so, you know, again, a lot of people just gave her the room to be a writer in the 90s, who, of course, didn't get everything, quote unquote, right. But here, she's really put a hard stop on it. And, you know, just kind of we discussed her politics and that they are generally to the left. And, you know, she sees herself as very queer friendly. And we, you know, could see that we assume that that queer friendly extended from GLB to T as well, but it does not. And that's really been quite a disconcerting and disappointing experience for all of us many fans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now it is time for today's Owl Post.
Look up. It's time for Owl Post.
Emily, would you like to read the question from Elise?
Yes. Elise asks, as a straight cis teacher, how do I approach teaching Harry Potter now, if at all? I've seen tweets from trans teachers and other trans folks who are so upset by Rowling's transphobia and say that teaching Harry Potter would be harmful to trans students, that it's a mode of colonization and reasserts that trans kids don't belong. So what do we do with this question? And Tyson Pugh, how would you contribute to a, if there was a handbook called Teaching Harry Potter in the Face of Transphobia, if at all, how would you what would you contribute to that manual?
You know, again, this is just an irony that I've addressed this issue not with Rowling in mind in previous classes. And it's when we discussed Rowling's biography and how does the author influence how we read and interpret text. And so for the past semesters that I've done it, my examples were Bill Cosby, right? Mm-hmm. And so The Cosby Show, you know, remains one of the most important sitcoms of television history. I mean, it offered a new view of Black families as not mired in poverty. And so, you know, not that there weren't some problems with its, you know, storylines or such as well, but on the whole, it really represented a watershed moment in television history. And now we know that Bill Cosby is a, you know, habitual rapist and is now in prison for it. And the other example I used was Woody Allen. And, you know, he has these very credible claims of child sexual abuse about him, mm-hmm. while undeniably being one of the greatest directors of 20th and 21st century film. So the first thing I do is I like to do this to, you know, just ask, get students thinking about it. How does it influence them? The irony is now when I do this lesson, my third example will be J.K. Rowling herself. And I hope we can have a productive conversation about, you know, what it means to read her books and how that, you know, how some of that pleasure might have shifted. Now, again, just because I was saying before, and so maybe some students will be able to read these books now as if they were written by an anonymous, and, you know, that they're not going to let J.K. Rowling's transphobia take away their enjoyment of her books, and that they are still, you know, they can still love the books. I think it's a really personal question to ask yourself as a reader, how much it influences you. I think the, you know, the most important thing is to state unequivocally that trans lives matter, that, you know, these are real people, there are students in our classes, and to affirm them. So this is the first time I'll have to address this as a teacher this coming semester. So I hope I do it well. I hope I do it respectfully. But I have to say, I'm more than annoyed. I'm quite angered with J.K. Rowling for introducing this into the class.
Yeah, and
it's,
you know,
give us some challenging discussions. But
right, and I think one of the things that I'm inspired by is you were talking about the fanon, and that fans have done a lot that is quite trans-friendly. And, you know, they've added extra stories and they've re-envisioned Hogwarts and they've, you know, the way that they do Quidditch. I mean, I think that there is a even caring beyond J.K. Rowling that the fans are able to do from the basis that J.K. Rowling gave us.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's valuable.
I think so. I mean, she can't she has the copyright, but she does not have full control, right? And I think that's a really great way to kind of re-envision what the series is for people who now feel maybe alienated from it. But at the same time, if, you know, if a trans person or any person says, I don't want to read these books because I don't want to be associated with that, I understand that. Yeah. And yeah, it's going to be, it's going to be an interesting class, and I'm interested to see how my teaching of the class shifts. And also, right, I mean, I haven't thought it through enough because it is such a big issue, but do I stop teaching the class? And I don't know the answer to that yet, because I think it's a good class. I think the class has a lot of value, but I don't want to support, you know, anti-trans ideologies. So can I do that? Can I teach a class in a way that I think is not supporting anti-trans ideologies?
So one of the exercises, Tyson, I have a class that I've taught as a freshman seminar, and I call it Harry Potter and the Liberal Arts. And I sort of talk about how people from different disciplinary perspectives have used Harry Potter. And we don't read a Harry Potter novel, but we read the little ancillary works. And one of the bits of Rowling's writing that I've used successfully in the class is the introduction to Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the textbook.
Yeah.
Which is in the genre of like encyclopedia, you know,
right.
Zoology, magizoology. And she has in the introduction to that book this discussion of the controversy of when magical people tried to distinguish between beings and beasts. And it leaves it pretty clear that drawing binaries like that is divisive.
Right.
It's not representative. It's not helpful. And that when I taught it before, I taught it as a sort of entree into some scientific discussions about, you know, where's the line between human beings and other animals, like chimpanzees or orangutans, which is actually sort of strikingly tricky. But the next time I teach it, I think I'm going to use that as an example of a sort of entry point into talking about sex binaries.
Yes.
And she has this line in that introduction that is like she should think about it. Imperfect understanding is often more dangerous than ignorance. And I think that we all need to be thinking about that in relation to trans issues right now. And so I think that that's one thing that I thought, I've done that before, but I think that would actually be a good way to actually get students to think about that issue through her writing that is totally contradictory to what she herself appears to be saying.
That's, again, one of the most frustrating parts of it is that she doesn't recognize how the themes of her own novels apply to the situation that she's decided to erroneously pontificate on.
And the role of fear. I mean, it's clear that she's not recognizing the role of her own fear in shaping her perspective. And how her books argue against that. So, you know, with putting Gryffindor as the heroic house.
Well, that brings us to the end of our episode today. Thank you so much, Dr. Tyson Pugh, for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure and a lot of fun.
What a wonderful conversation. And I hope that everyone will pick up Dr. Pugh's book, Harry Potter and Beyond, which is University of South Carolina Press, 2020. You will find so much, although we've had a, you know, quite wide-ranging discussion, you will see that we have not really hit nearly all of the wonderful things in the book. So there's just so much, so many little treasures there that I think people
all
will really enjoy.
All that and so much more.
That's right. Well, for this episode in which we've probed Rowling's literary brain, I am calling on Severus Snape for some wisdom. While teaching Harry occlumency, Professor Snape warns, "The mind is not a book to be opened at will and examined at leisure. Thoughts are not etched on the inside of skulls to be perused by any invader. The mind is a complex and many-layered thing."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to PotterversityPodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.